ahead on Straight Talk.
We don't need more partisan hacks. We need more people who have run small businesses.
A conversation with U.S. Representative Marie Glusenkamp-Perez.
It seems to me that 90% of us agree about 90% of the issues.
Representing Washington State's historically purple 3rd Congressional District, she finds herself in a precarious balancing act.
There's a lot of frustration, and if she's not aware of the level of frustration, that's on her.
We ask her how she's weighing her legislative priorities.
I refuse to let federal inaction undermine the opportunities our kids have.
With those of her constituents.
How do you justify possible disenfranchisement of millions of legal voters?
And navigating a Republican majority in the House paired with a second Trump presidency. Right now on Straight Talk. Hello and welcome to Straight Talk. Thanks for joining us. I'm Stephanie Domerat. Now this week we hear from the U.S. Representative for Washington's politically diverse 3rd District, Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. Congresswoman Glusenkamp-Perez was elected to serve in the House of Representatives for Washington's 3rd District for the first time back in 2022. Prior to jumping into politics, she co-owned and operated an auto repair and machine shop with her husband. Glusenkamp-Perez is in her second term and currently serves on the House Appropriations Committee. Congresswoman, thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, glad to be here.
I know you just got back from D.C. not that long ago, so we will dive right in. Of course, though, now you're several months into your second term. How have you approached this term differently than the last?
Well, I'm still in the minority in the House, you know, and I would say the daily experience of most members of my community has not changed significantly. People still can't afford to get a mortgage. You know, housing availability, fentanyl, childcare access, pathways to building wealth and economic self-determination. You know, those things have been relatively constant struggles. And so just staying close to home and staying close to what people believe in and what we think is worth having at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of chaos, there's a lot of tweeting. And I think ultimately the productive strategy is to stay focused on a positive policy agenda. Mm-hmm. What do we want? What are the root causes of the struggles that we're facing? And how do we stay oriented around what is useful policy and not like posturing?
Have you felt like in your second term you've been able to be more accomplished in doing that than in your first?
Yeah, well, I was able to make it onto Appropriations Committee, which is a really, that has been a success for our community. You know, representing how we want to see our federal tax dollars spent. Like, what does real efficiency look like? You know, how do we advance the strategic structural reform of agencies to ensure that our federal tax dollars are going to the programs that are the nuts and bolts of good governance, you know, not dog parks, but water treatment facilities.
Since the beginning of your time in office, you focused really on being a voice for working people, everyday people issues, like you're mentioning. Right now, what do you think is your number one priority for families in Southwest Washington?
Well, it's quality of life, and that is the cost of living. It is fentanyl. It is moving our society back to a position where people have time with their families, where people are getting sleep, where you can have single earner households and coach Little League, and you have a level playing field for small businesses and not a regulatory moat. It's not just a focus on cheap stuff, but our identity as people who have agency, who make things, who can build things, who can define for themselves what they want, not being told that they have a problem that some agency is going to fix for you, maybe.
That kind of relates to my next question. So a major part of your platform has been supporting trade jobs, hands-on skills. We are seeing tariffs used more aggressively by the Trump administration as a move to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. It's a move that does have some Americans very worried because it's already expensive to buy groceries, different things you need, as you mentioned. What is your take on the president's use of tariffs?
Well, you know, a structural question that I can't get away from is why are we importing 40% of the fresh fruits and vegetables we consume? How did we get here? You know, foreign ownership of farmland, farm consolidation, stopping the erasure of the timber industry here in the Northwest. I think tariffs are a tool that can be used productively or destructively. In and of themselves, they aren't sufficient to bringing back domestic manufacturing or domestic food production. To do that, we really need to have a clear focus on the kinds of permitting reform that have impeded a lot of the infrastructure projects that we rely on to bring down the cost of energy and heating and cooling and making things here that last.
Do you think that this move to increase tariffs is a good one by the president?
Well, I think that reciprocal tariffs can be a backdoor for sweetheart deals for multinationals. Hmm. I think how they're done really matters. I think that they are not, they can be destructive, they can be constructive, they're certainly not a panacea. You're not gonna bring back domestic manufacturing if you don't address permitting reform. You're not.
So you feel like what I'm hearing is potentially these tariffs that we are seeing and the amount of them could be good as long as we had the other steps in place or the other reforms in place. Is that what you're saying?
We want predictability in the tariffs, the way that it shouldn't just be a whatever the tweet, you know, whichever way the wind's blowing on tweets, but it should be a clear national policy of what is worth having. How do we build back the base? You know, our shop, like, we've seen the deterioration of the quality of parts, you know, right out of the box, like, say 1 out of 8 parts we're getting from overseas just fails. And we've shifted more towards remanufacturing and using older American parts. And I think that that's important. That's not gonna happen everywhere. It's not gonna happen on the East Coast where they salt the roads and cars don't last. But it is important that we have some threshold. We have domestic manufacturing so that the quality can't fall below a certain point.
So you do appreciate this goal that the president has stated?
I think we all want to get back to a place where we have, you know, an industrial economy and self-sufficiency. But how it's done, it's always the devil's always in the details.
How, what are you hearing from your constituents about this?
I think people are giving this administration grace and the time it takes. People realize that, you know, you don't flip a switch. I think there's a lot of consternation, in ag and especially in the commodity farming about how this is going to impact us. But, you know, people in my community have very sophisticated understandings and arguments about Canadian lumber dumping. And that's been it's not remote. It depends on the specifics of who and where and what, you know. And I think having more attention from our trade partners on the manufacturing and trafficking of fentanyl precursors has been a good thing. You know, there was a massive fentanyl bust in Vancouver, British Columbia earlier this year. Canadians paying more attention. I understand that in negotiations with the Chinese, they're also discussing the fentanyl precursor manufacturing as part of the trade policy.
I want to move on to now the House of Representatives, what you're seeing right now in the House. You are in the minority again, as you mentioned, and last week the House passed a massive policy bill that President Trump dubbed a big, beautiful bill. It includes extending tax cuts, expanding the military, beefing up border security, while cutting spending in areas like Medicaid and SNAP benefits. You voted against the bill, but if it passes the Senate, what could this mean for the American people?
Well, there are massive cuts planned for Medicaid coming down in 28, I think is the way it's structured right now. And those are programs that we rely on in my community. And you know, it's easy for people to feel like it's abstract right now, mm-hmm. but
yeah.
you know, I was just doing some roundtables and tours with some of our corrections officers in jails, and you know, those folks will tell you, they are on the front lines. When we cut Medicaid funding, now their detainees have untreated psychosis, massive drug addiction that they can't get out from under. You know, when the state shut down beds at Western State Hospital, my corrections officers drew a direct line to now, you know, being ejaculated on by detainees or having to pull toilet paper out of their throats who are trying to commit suicide. I mean, it's not abstract for a lot of us what this will mean.
So when this passed the House, you know, what did that mean for you?
Well, I mean, as a small business owner, and I think a lot of people in my community, we understand what debt means. We understand the necessity of having a balanced budget. And it was definitely disappointing for me to see, look, they control the House, the Senate, and the executive branch, and they're adding $3.8 trillion to the deficit. This is unsustainable rates. And I wish that our national debt were being taken with more seriousness and urgency. And, you know, I want to see American citizens getting the support they need. You know, I believe in creating a more effective, efficient program, rooting out fraud, waste. I believe in having strong national borders, but we've got to do it in a way that doesn't wrong-foot us in the longer fights ahead of economic self-determination.
I want to talk about government efficiency and cuts. Elon Musk's role in government, specifically leading the Department of Government Efficiency, has been widely criticized. What were your takes on his efforts and what's come out of that?
Yeah, what's come out of that is the question, right? I think there's broad public demand for a more efficient, effective government. I read a paper that said that people who've applied for a government service holding everything else equal are less likely to vote. You know, I understand that the application to get food stamp benefits in California is like 300 questions long. There is bloat, there's inefficiency, there is administrative, you know, spiraling. But randomly scapegoating civil servants is not getting us anywhere closer to a goal of a more effective, efficient government. And ultimately, it's work that needs to happen in Congress to provide more clarity on how these programs should be run, not just adding on more report language, more, you know, more studies, but the actual, what is the program designed to do and how do we move it closer to doing that more quickly?
If you were in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency or you had, you know, the magic wand to do that, you know, where would you cut and what would you look at?
Well, you know, the VA, if you wrote out the whole system for the VA, it is 8 feet tall and 20 feet long, and a lot of it is in 12-point font. No one would design a program like that today. It's just been kind of layer after layer of bureaucracy and something that sounds like a good idea or makes for good reading but is awful to implement. And so I think, you know, the kinds of permitting reform that have been proposed in previous legislations, picking those up again, figuring out how those fell off the table. How are we going to build more power lines? How are we going to, you know, advance electrification and provide, you know, choice and flexibility to consumers who are relying on being able to heat their homes in the increasingly, you know, erratic weather?
Your district is politically diverse and voted for President Trump in both elections. What are you hearing now from your constituents about his second term?
Yeah, my district's voted for Trump all three times that it was on the ballot. This was not drawn to be a purple seat. This is a red seat. And I think, you know, you have some folks who like the policies, don't like the person. So you have some people who like the person and not the policies. But this is somebody who increased their vote share. And it's important to think about what, with, you know, humility and curiosity about what do we want? You know, we do want a more effective government. We do want to have border security. It's not crazy to say that, you know, you think that only U.S. citizens should determine the outcome of American elections. And I think the goal here is to figure out how to build a stronger country, to listen to your neighbors and to be in community, and not a reflexive resistance, but thinking about what is the germ here, the core thing that we want, and that doesn't mean endorsing the way that they're going after it or trying to get at it. It should be a affirmation that they give people. Like it when the police show up when you call them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of everyday real things that we can all agree on, it sounds like, in those ways. What grade would you give President Trump?
It's challenging to, well, for one thing, I guess the kind of the academic, like, grading it, it's right. How is the metric built in the first place? What is the scorecard based on what?
As leader in command, what would you, his work so far in this second term?
Well, I will say, there have been some issues where I've been encouraged. You know, he came out in support of ending the carried interest tax loophole, which I lead on in the House. He came out in support of military right to repair, which I also lead on in the House. There are certainly areas of agreement, but I think, the way that we get there matters. We want to know, and we have a right to know, who and what is coming in and out of our country. But we also know that the only inoculant against a government that moves towards, kleptocracy or authoritarianism, it is the system itself. It is due process. So you don't cut off your nose to spite your face. Mm-hmm. You affirm that, yes, we have this shared value, but the way we get there really matters.
Do you want to give a grade for him?
I don't think so. I don't know that's productive.
Okay, well, you have received some pushback from constituents who feel you aren't representing the Democratic Party's values. About a month ago at a PAC town hall in Vancouver, you answered questions. The meeting turned quite contentious. Now, one moment that drew criticism was when answering a question about your support for the SAVE Act, which would require proof of citizenship to register to vote. Let's take a listen to this.
Americans believe that only U.S. citizens should be determining the outcome of the And any idea that I am standing to disenfranchise people is
Now, critics of the SAVE Act argue it could disenfranchise legal citizens who don't have easy access to required documentation. So you've said you're voting based on your constituents' concerns after you saw and heard so much pushback. Do you regret the way that you voted in that case?
No. I mean, one thing that gets left out of a lot of the discussion is that legislation, as flawed as it was, also had a clause that allowed voters to sign a statement and testify that they are U.S. citizens. So a lot of this argument about it disenfranchising is missing some of the core points. I've actually voted for the bill 3 times now. It's never moved through the Senate because of the flaws in the implementation strategy. But at its core, like, part of my job is to affirm that basic interest and that basic belief that, yeah, U.S. citizens should be the ones determining the outcome of our election. And, a lot of the arguments, about like this is going to disenfranchise rural married women. I'm mm-hmm. a rural married woman, mm-hmm. and I think a lot of us feel like, when we need somebody to speak for us, we'll let you know. But right now, it is a shared common value in my district that voting should be a secure process. We saw in Oregon under the motor voter law, 900 people registered to vote without who should not have been registered. Now, like 30 of them actually voted in the election. And you'll hear arguments about how rare it is. But we're not just stewards of a spreadsheet. We are guardians of national confidence in our election system. And so the absolute numbers are relevant, but they're not the only relevant issue. And having confidence in our election system delivering results that actually reflect the values and the choice of U.S. citizens.
Congresswoman, thank you. We're going to have to take a quick break, and we will be right back right after this. Stay with us. And welcome back to Straight Talk. This week, we are sitting down with Congresswoman for Washington's 3rd District, Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. Marie, thank you again for being here today. We'll dive right back into it. I know we were talking about some of the pushback you're seeing from the Democratic Party and your constituents around some issues. But beyond the SAVE Act we mentioned, some Democrats are also frustrated that you often don't vote along the lines of your party and you're not taking a strong enough stance against key issues and some of President Trump's agenda. Now, a former Democratic candidate for District 3, Brent Henrich, has already thrown in his name, his hat, into the hat to run against you in 2026. And in a statement, he said, quote, "I am running for Congress because our district deserves a leader who will steadfastly uphold Democratic ideals and work tirelessly for our entire community's best interests." What's your response to that?
I don't think what's missing from the political process is more partisanship. I think that we're all really tired of having DC partisanship inflicted on our communities. And, you know, most folks don't, they're not putting Democrat or Republican on their gravestone. They want to have a representation that reflects their priorities and brings their values to DC, not inflicting partisan ideals back at home. We should be informing, you know, the party and not the other way around.
Because you run as a Democrat, though, and you represent the Democratic Party, do you feel that you identify with Democrats right now?
Oh, I am a Democrat, and the reason that I'm a Democrat, I think, look, it's actually crazy to me that some of these things that have become party ideology are. They feel quite removed from the reasons that I'm a Democrat. You know, I think I believe in the agency and honor of working in the trades. I believe in building stuff, having a relationship to the natural world around you, not of just recreation, but of dependence. And, you know, the kinds of, I think, tax policies, like, you know, let's make sure that we're supporting the trades and all forms of intelligence and not just advancing the paper ceiling and the credentialing and the, you know, shoehorning everyone into college.
Are you going to continue doing these town halls? I know you've heard a lot of pushback recently.
Oh, yeah. I've held 15 so far and have, you know, I'm very committed to doing in-person town halls all across the district. I think it's really important to go and hear from people, not just the folks that are, you know, in a population center, but at all across the district. I learn a lot and I value those.
Were you surprised at some of the things that people have been saying or the pushback you've heard?
I mean, people are upset and they have a lot of reason to be upset. And I am not here to police their feelings. I also believe that, you know, my job is to represent the entirety of the district. It's a big district with really broad political views, and it shouldn't just be about who is loudest or who has the ability to take time off from work and go somewhere to, you know, a meeting, but representing people who are working 3 jobs, who are late for daycare pickup, who are, you know, working overtime. Those folks deserve a voice too, and so I work to make sure I'm hearing from a balanced, representative kind of sample of my neighbors and community.
Our final question, if you had the power to change one policy issue facing Washingtonians and Oregonians, what would it be?
Ooh. I think that a lot of, well, you know, I'm diehard on right to repair.
Yeah.
You know, and that points back towards this issue of economic self-determination, that you should be able to play on a level playing field and build things that last, that you should be able to raise a family on one income. You know, a lot of the things that we see that we don't like, I mean, you know, our public schools are pretty much predicated on having single earner households where parents were able to be involved. Where people were able to, you know, have a relationship with their neighbors. Those are the things that build democracy. And so unwinding some of these antitrust issues, trying to build more wealth in the middle class, that's how you keep a strong democracy in the long run.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for being with us. We are out of time. We appreciate your time today. And thank you so much for watching us. Here on Straight Talk, coming up next week, we sit down with the editor and vice president of The Oregonian as she nears retirement after 40-plus years. Have a great week. We'll see you then.